Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Centre for the Study of Modern and Contemporary History podcast. My name is Emile Chabal, and I was, until a few days ago, the director of the Centre. Now, fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, my successor, Judy Gibbings, who actually appeared as a guest on this podcast a month ago, has let me continue in my role as podcast host for a little longer. So you might be forced to hear my voice a little bit more in the coming months. In any case, if you're listening to this, you're probably aware that it's part of our CSMCH Showcase series, in which we interview members of the Centre about their intellectual biographies and their research. After speaking last time to one of our most senior academics, Enda Delaney, about Ireland and the history of cognition, we'll be talking today about exciting new research from one of our PhD students, Anita Klingler. Like Enda, but not for exactly the same reasons, Anita has been in Edinburgh for longer than I have, since she started her undergraduate degree here way back in 2009. She's therefore seen the university in many different forms, as a fresh-faced first-year undergraduate, and most recently as a no doubt slightly more cynical and perhaps slightly more jaded PhD student on the verge of graduating. She's also, and I must mention this here, been one of the most devoted centre members over the years, attending virtually every talk and meeting since 2017 and helping to organise all sorts of things from our Twitter feed to our student-focused events. But Anita is not just a good academic citizen, she's also a multilingual scholar, something which she put to very good use in her undergraduate dissertation, which I discovered recently was about Hindi to English code switching in North India. But fortunately, we're able to rescue her from the lure of sociolinguistics, and she's been branded as a historian throughout her postgraduate studies. And in particular, Anita spent the last few years working on the question of violence in interwar Europe, a period often known to historians of 20th century Europe as one of permanent civil war, from the outbreak of World War I through the Russian revolutions and civil war, the rise of fascism in Italy and Germany, the collapse of democracy across Europe, the Spanish Civil War, and finally the unending horror of the Second World War, the effects of which lasted for many years after 1945. And if all of this stuff seems pretty familiar to you, well, that's because it is familiar. But this rather grim familiarity is often a problem for historians because it fixes certain narratives about the interwar period that can be difficult to break. And one of the most tenacious of these is that Britain was a surprisingly peaceful country in this period, while Germany was the archetype of the violent and increasingly violent society. Now, in her thesis, Anita tries to challenge these prevalent narratives about national cultures and their relationship to violence. At face value, of course, the levels of political violence in interwar Britain and Germany were very, very different. But some of these differences begin to fade away when you look at what was happening in the British Empire in Ireland or the Middle East, for example. And most importantly, perhaps Anita's thesis, which I've really enjoyed looking at over the past week or so, makes us think about how violence actually begins and how languages and discourses of violence can lead naturally to physical violence. And I expect during our discussion today, we'll have cause to reflect on how these insights might help to explain some of the political processes that are taking place today in 2020 as well. So without further ado, let's get straight to business. Anita, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start with a biographical question. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you got interested in interwar Europe. And this is interesting, particularly because from what I understand, you were more of a specialist of post-war Europe until the start of your PhD and then moved backwards and developed this interest in the interwar period. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So as an undergrad and as a master student, I kind of looked at post-45 Europe, and particularly German history mainly. I'm from Germany, after all. So I think that's where that interest came from. But I guess it was kind of twofold. After studying post-1945 history and quote-unquote, you know, coming to terms with this violent past, I guess I just almost naturally, I would think, started to think further backwards and became interested in, well, how did all of this happen, you know, the 12 years of German history. And I think the other thing that was happening at the same time was that I started to conceive of this project in about 2014-15, and that's when the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War was really kind of a big topic. And these two different kind of strands happening in parallel kind of made me more interested in the interwar period, and kind of, on the one hand, the effect of this, you know, cataclysmic world war, and how societies could hope to recover from that, and how it impacted and changed attitudes towards violence to have gone through such an experience. And then, yeah, on the other hand, kind of thinking backwards from a post-Second World War point, well, how did we get there? So basically, those two directions, and that led me to wanting to look at those in-between years.
And why choose the topic of violence? I mean, of course, in this particular period of European history, it's fairly obvious standout topic, and it's become something of an obsession. I mean, certainly as a European historian, I'm well aware of how students, for instance, are fascinated almost in a macabre way with the way in which Europe tore itself apart in such violent fashion in the 20s, 30s and 40s. Was there a similar motivation for you, or did you come at violence from a different perspective?
It's a difficult question. I think probably early on, yeah, I was probably also one of those people who was a bit kind of fascinated or obsessed with it, in the sense that, I don't know, I don't think we necessarily know the same level of violence, at least in our personal lives, thankfully, nowadays, certainly not where and how I grew up. So it seems very, I don't know, almost abstract, and I don't know, really hard to understand, really hard to grasp how such enormous violence could happen, how people could participate in it to such an extent. These kind of questions, I think, that obviously a lot of people, yeah, I don't know, find fascinating, like you say. So that stood at the beginning of the project. But then as the last 4 or 5 years, I guess, the time over which I was doing this thesis, they kind of went on, violence became more of a current, or kind of a closer topic again. It's kind of made its way, if you want, much closer to home, with various kinds of terrorism and other violent events domestically that happen in Western societies. And I think that my interest in violence changed over the years, and it towards the end was guided more by that interest than a purely historical interest in what happened back then, and more bound up with what's happening currently.
Yeah, I noticed in your thesis that you're very keen to push back against the idea of Britain in particular as a peaceful society. And I'm very, very sympathetic to this argument that you're making. It's quite difficult, though, isn't it? Because the self-perception of the British, and particularly the British elites, is of continuity. That is, that Britain has somehow been governed in the same way by the same people for hundreds of years without any real change, and has remained somehow out of the orbit of a lot of the big ideological and revolutionary changes of modern European history. Did you find that you were continuously having to push against that, or were you using tools from other European countries to try and understand Britain?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what you say is absolutely right. You know, Britain has been governed by the same people and the same institutions for centuries, basically. And that's precisely why this kind of reckoning with the past, if you want, is so painful, because I think it is painful. And we're seeing it today. We're seeing it in particularly, you know, in the Black Lives Matter protests, for example. It's not something that a lot of people are ready to, I don't know, acknowledge or deal with. And I think that continuity and that perception of that continuity is one of the reasons, probably. I almost think that my great advantage in doing this is that I am an outsider. I come from it as a foreigner, not someone who's grown up in Britain with that culture, with that education system, with that history and identity. And so I almost, I think, approached it with a level of innocence or naivety, where I just thought, well, I'm going to treat Britain the same as any other country and not assume that there's anything, you know, exceptional about it. And so that's, I think, also what really encouraged me in pursuing a comparative angle, because it seemed, you know, why not? Britain is not above a comparison with other countries, not even when it comes to violence in the interwar years. So yeah, I think just an outsider's perspective maybe was quite helpful in doing that.
And I wonder, is there a perception in Germany as well that Britain is or has been uniquely peaceful, either compared to Germany or just in general? Because it strikes me that very often in other European countries, there is the same perception of Britain that the British have of themselves.
That's a good question. I don't think I'm really equipped to answer it. I've not existed in German academia really ever, as you said. I've been in the UK pretty much since 2009. So I'm not entirely sure. I think you're probably right that it is easy for others as well to accept that narrative that Britain definitely didn't have the same kinds of problems, if you want, that Germany did in the interwar years, which, you know, in absolute terms, that is true. But yeah, I don't know. It's tricky, and I don't know that I can properly weigh in.
Let's talk a bit about sources and like good historians. Your thesis is based very much on newspaper sources as a sort of backbone of the thesis. Why did you choose newspapers as a window into discourses on violence?
Yes, so it's based on newspapers mainly, as you say, and then kind of the second pillar are parliamentary debates. And I chose those because what I'm interested in really is a thing that, you know, you might call public language or public speech or public discourse. I kind of use those terms almost interchangeably because I'm interested in what is possible to say in a public forum. What kinds of violence are possible to defend publicly? What kinds seem to be crossing a line? What kinds have to be condemned, even though they might be approved of in private communications or whatever? But what do you have to condemn publicly? What's not okay? And what is okay? And what are the kinds of things that you can publicly construct an excuse or a reason for or a necessity? And so, obviously, there are many sources probably that you could use to kind of investigate this kind of public speech, but I chose perhaps, you know, the most obvious and maybe the most abundant, which is the press, which is newspapers. They are an inherently public forum, and I kind of conceived of Parliament in the same way that it is an inherently public forum, that what you say there, you know, that's not private. That is very much out there to be heard. And so what is said there is said there for a reason and with thought behind it. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much why I chose those sources.
And do you think you can actually make some sort of theory of the relationship, if you like, between those public discourses surrounding violence and then private practices of violence or actual practices of violence? What for you is the relationship between the two? Obviously, your thesis is about discourses of violence, and that in and of itself is an enormous topic. But do you feel strongly that certain discourses of violence then lead to actual violence, actual physical violence, or is the relationship perhaps more complicated than that?
Yeah, well, as you said, it's, you know, that was not kind of a major part of the thesis, but speaking to what I personally think, I think there is a relationship. I think it's sometimes more direct than at other times. Obviously, if a political leader directly incites their followers to violence, for example, that I think is quite an obvious one. But then there are kind of broader processes that happen where, you know, if newspapers bit by bit normalize certain kinds of language, or if they continuously present certain violent events, violence perpetrated against certain people or in a certain place as necessary or as good even, or as restoring law and order or things like that, then I think, yeah, that does change attitudes over time. And obviously it won't lead everyone to pick up a gun or punch their neighbor in the face, but it might lead some people to think that certain types of violence are acceptable if that's the language that's used around it in public. And if it's in particular connected to, as I say in my thesis quite a lot, if it's connected to certain self-images, to certain ideas of identity, and if you identify as German or as British, then, you know, you must by necessity condone violence against certain other groups, for example. Yeah, so I think there is very much a connection. It's not always, not necessarily direct, but, you know, it is there.
In methodological terms, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the challenges of writing about violence. There's been a great deal of talk in recent years about the difficulties, not just in finding out about how violence happened and trying to get an accurate picture of that historically, but also the consequences, emotional or otherwise, on the person writing about violence. And of course, the responsibility that the historian has towards those who are being written about. What did you find were some of the most important challenges you faced as you started to write about these really fundamental political phenomena of the interwar period?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, yeah, you're right in saying that it's twofold, or at least twofold, that on the one hand, yes, reading about violence and then writing about it has an effect on yourself if you're doing that. But yeah, a challenge is also how you do the victims of that violence justice in your writing and how you portray it. I'm quite grateful and I think consciously didn't choose to write about the violence itself. You know, it's not a thick description of violent events or something like that. I'm not sure I'd be cut out for that. You know, I looked at language about violent events more than the events themselves, and that kind of puts sometimes already one kind of level of remove into that. Yeah, I mean, as the person researching it, writing about it yourself, it can be emotionally challenging to read about awful stuff and then kind of having to figure out how to write about it. And yeah, so sometimes you just need to take a break. So if it's getting to be too much, I think that's fair. And that's something you need to allow yourself. And it's good, I think, that that's more of a thing now. It's becoming more of a thing.
What about the responsibility you feel or don't feel towards the national cultures that you are dealing with, Britain and Germany? Of course, as we talked about earlier, in Britain, there's very much a sense that the history of 20th century Britain has been uniquely peaceful. I think most Germans would agree that it's exactly the opposite in the German case, that there was something especially perhaps uniquely violent about the 20th century in Germany. Did you ever at any point feel a responsibility towards this national British culture or national German culture? Did you feel you were writing against one of these cultures? You said earlier on that you were in some ways writing against this British a notion of peaceful continuity. Were you also writing against a similar German notion or German myth?
I'm not too sure. I think it's difficult to write against kind of the notion that Germany's history in that particular period, you know, was violent, because that is, I think, quite clearly fact. I mean, I really don't know. You are right that I wrote kind of against this tendency towards British exceptionalism. I thought that was something that was kind of worth trying to knock down a bit. And kind of this strict separation often between, you know, British history and European history, and, you know, the Britain being separate from the continent, and that these histories don't either intersect or they don't have too much in common. And even if at the end of the thesis I find that, yeah, there were a lot of differences, it's still worth comparing them because you learn more about each one, obviously, in the process.
So already several points we've alluded to the contemporary relevance of the research you're doing. What can your research, what can your conclusions tell us about political, economic situation that Europe finds itself in present day?
I wish it could tell us useful things. I don't know that is true. Obviously, yeah, it's come up already a couple of times, but I think I don't know, I'm mostly interested in history as it relates to the present. That's just me and my interests. And as I said, it really evolved over the last 4 or 5 years. I think everyone can probably relate to that. You know, there's all these opinion pieces about whether we're reliving the 30s or whether fascism is rising again, and all these kinds of questions. And I don't know that I have an answer to that. I definitely don't think there's compelling arguments, and I haven't made up my mind. Well, I don't know if there's any take-home lessons. I think there's obviously the hope that by continuing to examine this period in the past, we can continue to kind of learn various useful things, not some grand lesson, but bits and pieces and points where you realise, oh, you know, we've maybe seen these arguments before, or this is what's happening with kind of the normalisation of certain types of language in press or in the political sphere. And that, I think, is maybe the only transferable idea there, because yeah, history isn't going to repeat. It's not going to happen the same way again. There are new challenges now, and they have to be faced kind of in new ways. Whatever threat to democracy we have maybe now is very much rooted in the 21st century, and it's not what it was 100 years ago. So yeah, I think maybe the main thing it can contribute towards is just urging vigilance, maybe, and kind of sharpening the eye or the ear, if you like, for certain kinds of processes that happen in public discourse that can normalize types of violence, that can, as we discussed earlier, that I believe do then lead to actual violence. So I think, yeah, there's not too many direct lessons to learn, but some points to reflect on.
But it is interesting, though, isn't it, that some of the political questions to which you're alluding, whether that be Donald Trump with a capital T, or, you know, Black Lives Matter, which we mentioned earlier on, or indeed the rise of the far right in Germany, many of these things are intimately connected to violence. I mean, they're very closely related, actually, some of the themes that you discuss in your thesis, and perhaps you're underselling the relevance of your analysis, because, for instance, in the British case, it seems to me there is something of a reckoning surrounding the violence of the British state, particularly beyond the borders of Great Britain. And that's been taking place slowly, but is, you know, I think it's coming to a head. And in Germany, of course, with the return of the far right, there's the return of a spectre which, at least in post-war West Germany and even in East Germany, people thought had disappeared forever, and that is the ghost of Nazism looming in the form of Pegida, or the IFD. So there are some really strong links, actually, between some of the themes I was reading your thesis and some of these contemporary political questions.
Yes, yeah, no, I think the links are there, and I would hope that by kind of doing research like that, maybe I can make those links more obvious, so that they might seem obvious to me, and obviously they are obvious to you, but maybe not to everyone. So yes, I guess if I can contribute to that, that's of value. What I don't think is that I have solutions. And I don't think that solutions that maybe would have worked 100 years ago would work today. I think that's what I meant to say, that we still need to grapple with it in the present and in ways that are appropriate and relevant to the contemporary context, obviously. If that's to do with the new kinds of media that are out there, I dread to think how future historians would analyze this time period. I was drowning in newspapers, and I was looking at the 20s and 30s. How anyone would wade through Twitter or Facebook comments, I don't know. You know, and there's a particular potential for people really kind of going down rabbit holes and creating those bubbles. Yeah, I don't think that we maybe can find answers in the past, but we can, you're right, we can find those connections, and we can use them as, you know, as really quite loud warning signs, probably.
Well, social media raises all kinds of fascinating questions about how media has changed and whether the form of media matters in terms of the content, and, you know, whether is a Facebook comment the same as a newspaper editorial? Well, clearly it's not, but what function do they play? Which kind of audiences do they reach, and so on? Those are questions which a future historian will need to unravel. Hopefully, the level of violence in the present day will not exceed that of the 1920s and 30s. It's a pretty bleak time in European history, but of course, we don't know what's coming next. But one thing's for sure is that research like the research you're doing is going to illuminate all kinds of different things. And having very much enjoyed dipping into your thesis, I can't wait to see exciting journal articles, or even perhaps one day a book come out of it. And I'm sure that other people will be interested to learn more about these discourses of violence. I sincerely hope that one of the big messages of your thesis, that violence lies just below the surface of British history, and sometimes bursts out into the open, is one that's heard, because as a European historian myself, it's a source of great frustration that Britain is, as you put it earlier, sort of held apart from its European neighbours. So very excited to see where your research goes. Thank you very much, Anita. Thanks for being with us today. And thanks to all of you for listening. Today's interview actually brings to an end our first cycle of CSMCH Showcase podcast. By the time this podcast is released, a new semester will be upon us, and we'll be trying to work out exactly how to survive in the online or partly online world that's surely going to be ours for the foreseeable future. However, we do intend to kick off another cycle of CSMCH Showcase podcasts soon, with new guests, new ideas, and new subjects for discussion. And I very much hope you'll be able to join us then. Until then, take care and stay safe.